Right, okay. Well, we're supposed to be discussing the news, but I mean, there's really only one news item, you know, at the moment. So I'm going to discuss that. If you want to discuss anything else afterwards, feel free to mention it. And you can guess what the item is. It's been, I've been following it. I'm sure that some of you have been following this every day as well. It's pretty hard to keep track. Everything I wrote down about this yesterday is old news by now. So I'm just going to sort of go through what I've observed and noted. And if you know it already, well, you know, please indulge me. There are some things I did find out that I think are interesting that, well, I certainly didn't know about the general area. So, you know. So we know what the situation is at the moment. The Israeli Defense Force has basically told over 1 million Palestinians that they've got 24 hours to get the hell out of Dodge and go and live in the southern desert in Gaza, you know, because they're going to go in and obliterate the city by the look of it. One Israeli official said Gaza will turn into a city of tents. So I think there's not much doubt. They pretty much intend to flatten what they haven't already flattened. So, you know, Hamas has sown the wind and Palestinian workers are going to reap the whirlwind. So there's a lot of talk about this being Israel's 9/11 moment. Pretty accurate in a way, considering the shock factor, the fact that the Israelis didn't see it coming. I've seen it argued that it's actually worse than that because in terms of deaths per population ratios, it's actually equivalent to about 6 or 7 9/11s to the Israelis. On their side, some Palestinians are calling this their Warsaw uprising moment. I don't know how other people reacted, but my first reaction was, well, something like this had to happen eventually because the Israelis have been pushing the Palestinians for so long on the West Bank with their extended expansionist settlements, their blockade of Gaza for 16 years. 60% of Gaza youth are unemployed, 80% of the population are dependent on international aid. But, you know, it's the workers who suffer, isn't it? It's not the government. It's not the people in charge. You know, and what Hamas did was pretty shocking. They slaughtered hundreds of people at a music festival and people living in kibbutzes. You know, this is, what can we say? This is yet another one of these wars between competing ruling classes and, you know, and also competing international power blocks. We've already got Ukraine going on. Now we've got this, you know, you're sort of tempted to wonder, is Taiwan next? You know, in the last few years, we've been used to seeing the environment being the sort of global issue of urgency, but the rate this is going, you know, that's going to be eclipsed by global hot wars. I was looking at the background of this area just recently. I was interested by an economist report, a short report, that the Saudi king was doing a goodwill charm offensive visiting Western countries. And that's when I found out about the Abraham Accords. Now, not everybody here may be familiar with this, so if you'll indulge me, what I'd like to do is do a little bit of a background sketch, not just to, you know, Israel, but to the whole Middle East theatre, because the more you look into it, the worse it gets. But to start with, the Abraham Accords, this was a set of bilateral agreements starting in 2020 between Israel on one side and Bahrain, UAE and Morocco on the other. It's free trade deals. It was mediated by the US. Apparently now there are Israeli tourists in Bahrain and UAE, which has never been seen before. So the deal is the Arab states recognise Israel, and in return they get free trade deals, they get advanced tech, including advanced Israeli weapons and surveillance tech. The Israelis are famous for their surveillance tech, notably Pegasus. And even in the case of the UAE, domestic nuclear power capability, courtesy of the United States, which gives them a realistic post-oil trajectory. Saudi Arabia is very keen on getting domestic nuclear power, and so Saudi Arabia was widely slated to be the next country to sign up to the Abraham Accords. Now, this process is being called normalization. So, you know, on the one side, Israel is normalized. It's accepted as being here to stay. On the other side of the normalization, the medieval monarchies also are accepted as being here to stay, now with the backing of the US in order to fight off any fundamentalist and republican movements. What came to mind when I was looking at this was that TV show Game of Thrones, because this really is about Arab monarchies who are terrified of Islamic radicalism or Nasser-style pan-Arab republicanism or the sort of even more militant version of that, which was Baathism, which Assad and Saddam Hussein both subscribed to, a sort of militant secular Arab nationalism. All of these see the monarchies as corrupt pawns of the West. And if you add to that the fact that Iran has also stated its explicit intention of dethroning all these monarchies, probably with extreme prejudice, you can see why there's a rush by these monarchies to make peace with Israel and the West. So that's normalization. That's the Abraham Accords. Who gets left out of this normalization, of course, is the Palestinians, who, you know, nobody's been interested to talk about in the last few years. People probably know that the sort of layout of countries in this area was pretty much the result of a deal between the French and the British during the First World War. The boundaries sort of, you know, paid no regard to sort of ethnic divisions, religious, cultural divisions, anything like that. People were just lumped together in the same state. Geography was ignored. Laying the groundwork for future wars. I mean, to take one example, Syria and especially Iraq rely for all their agriculture on the twin rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. But the headwaters of those two rivers rise in Turkey, which has been building dams across both of those rivers. So there's a potential future war just based on two rivers. The situation with Israel is quite is buried in history as well. Just after the Britain and France sort of carved these countries up out of the old Ottoman Empire, the British government issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, announcing its support for the national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This was written by Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour to Lord Rothschild for transmission to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland. Now, as far as I can work out, this was to encourage a Jewish uprising against the Ottomans, much in the same way that the British had also promised the Arabs a pan-Arab state through T. Lawrence of Arabia, for also rising against the Ottomans. Of course, nothing came of that. The British reneged on both those promises. but, of course, then we got to the Second World War. Loads of Jews fled to Palestine. That upset the demographics. Despite that, the Brits still would have ignored their Balfour statement, but the UN stepped in at that point and carved up Palestine giving 60% of the land to the Jews, even though the Arabs outnumbered them 2-1. If you look at a map now of Israel, if you're wondering why Gaza and the West Bank are two separate Palestinian enclaves, that's because it was set up that way by the United Nations. There then followed a forced diaspora of Palestinians out to Lebanon and Jordan, although much as they might claim they were forced off their own land, according to 1936 figures, when the British had the place as a mandate and they were busy slaughtering Palestinians instead of the Israelis, Palestinian landowners, actual owners of the land, were just 1/5 of 1% of the Palestinian population. So this comes from an article in the Social Standard back from 1982. So the argument is, you know, they weren't forced off their own land. They were forced off someone else's land. Anyway, all that being said, sort of no discussion of the background is complete without looking at oil reserves. And back when these decisions were being made in the First World War, very little oil was known about. There was some known about in Iran, but that was about it. And then, of course, it was discovered all over the place. But what I didn't know, and possibly you might not know either, is that where the oil is located is absolutely catastrophic from the point of view of any possible peace in the area. So 90% of Iran's oil is in one small coastal area on the west coast of Iran by the sea called Khuzestan, and that's not actually Iranian but Arab. So all the Iranian oil is in an Arab area. Going across the Gulf, there's the Kingdom of Bahrain, which is ruled by a Sunni monarchy, but has got an almost entirely Shiite population. Now, Bahrain used to be Persian, and Bahrain is to Iran what Taiwan is to China. They want it back, essentially. They always have wanted it back. Saudi Arabia is terrified that Iran might invade Bahrain because it's right next to almost all of their oil infrastructure and their largest oil fields. That's why the US Fifth Fleet is parked at Bahrain, and there's a big US air base next door in Qatar. Going further north, you've got Iraq, which is Sunni controlled, but all the oil is in the south in Basra province, which is Shia and Kurdish. The Sunni majority rule has got no oil in it. This, by the way, caused the 8-year Iran-Iraq war because Saddam feared losing all the oil in an Iranian takeover of Shiite Basra. It makes your head spin thinking of where the Shias are, where the Sunnis are. But, you know, these sort of groups have got more affiliation to their religion than to their nationality. So Saddam probably was right to fear that the Iranians would take over Basra. What he did instead was he tried to invade Khuzestan and take all Iran's oil. Then there's Kuwait, that was separated by the British from Iraq, and that's got as much oil as Iraq has. That's why Saddam invaded Kuwait. Next door to Kuwait, you've got Saudi Arabia. All their oil is bunched up in that small area of the Gulf Coast. As I said, if you get Bahrain, you can also get Kuwait. You can also get Saudi Arabia's oil, all in one go. So there was quite a real chance that Saddam Hussein could have captured all of that area and then controlled half of the world's oil supply. So you can sort of see why at that point the Americans got involved. Saudi Arabia is Sunni, of course, but where all its oil is located is where its Shia minority live. Again, almost none of the oil is in the Sunni majority areas. The same thing is true in Syria, believe it or not, which is Shia. but all the oil is in the northeast where the Sunni Kurds live. Okay. I'm sure I've made your head spin now, but basically all the oil is in the wrong place for the purposes of the ruling regimes, which means all these regimes are tyrannical. They're dominating populations that have got every reason to want to overthrow them, every reason to throw in their lot with some foreign power, every reason for the whole kind of map situation to blow up at any moment. The region has got a political seismology that's more violent than you'd see almost anywhere else in the world. And, of course, on top of all that, because of the oil, you've got all the big European powers, Russia and the US, wading in to stir the pot. And then there's Israel, of course. Israel was formerly America's policeman in the Gulf states. It didn't have its own natural resources. But you may or may not know that things have changed now because vast gas fields have been discovered off the coast of Gaza, making Israel a potentially vital exporter to the EU just when the West is cutting off all its supplies from Russia because of Ukraine. So now Israel is suddenly a big player. In just June of last year, the European Commission signed a trilateral agreement with Israel and Egypt. Egypt, because Egypt's got all the export oil terminals and gas terminals, for a trilateral memorandum of understanding on the supply of Israeli gas via Egypt to the EU. If I just share my screen a second, I've got a sort of map of the... can I do this? I've got a map of the gas fields off the Israeli coast. You can see that there's a huge one called the Tamar oil field, gas field, right off the Gaza Strip. That's now been shut in the last few days by Chevron that operates it. There are two others that you can see there. There's the Leviathan gas field and the Karish gas field. These are enormous. These are going to make Israel a major player. But if you look further inland towards the coast, I don't know if you can make out the coast there, you'll see one called Gaza Marine. Okay. Now, Gaza Marine is interesting because it was discovered in the 1990s and legally, by international law, it belongs to Gaza, not to Israel. And therefore, it belongs to Hamas. I'll just come and unshare my screen now, if I can... All right. Hamas couldn't develop this gas field. Nobody could develop this gas field because it required Israeli approval, and not surprisingly, Israel never gave approval. But what is surprising is only a few months ago, in June this year, Israel changed its mind and did agree that the Gaza Marine gas field could be developed. And this raises the question, why? Why did they suddenly agree to develop a gas field that was going to benefit Gaza and especially Hamas? Well, they announced the decision at the same moment that they announced further West Bank colonial expansions. So the thinking is that they might have been hoping to appease US sensibilities. The US have always been uncomfortable with these West Bank sensibilities because, as far as the US has been concerned, Israel has always been a dog that's got a bit out of control and won't come to heel when it's supposed to. But it might also be that the Israelis agreed to this because they've been offering sweeteners to Gaza in the last couple of years. Surprising, considering what's just happened, but this is actually the case. They've been they 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 set up a deal where 100,000 Gazans were given a cross-border pass so that they could go and get jobs in Israel at 10 times the wages that they would earn in Gaza. As a sort of response to this, Hamas in the last couple of years has stopped launching rockets into Israel as a sort of quid pro quo. So really, Israel, I'll come on to this in a minute, but Israel had reasonable grounds for thinking that things in Gaza were fairly stable. This wasn't the case with another group, militant, the Islamic Jihad. They carried on launching rockets, but I'll leave them aside for the moment. Now, Israel might have made this decision about the gas fields in order to swing Gaza away from militant Islamic Jihad, possibly away from Hamas as well. Hamas have been losing popularity in Gaza over the last couple of years, partly because they've been seen to have been going soft on Israel. But also, Israel's got a similar deal with Lebanon over its gas fields. And this is also possibly soft power trying to swing Lebanese popular opinion away from Hezbollah by giving all these parties something to lose. And this gas money is, of course, desperately needed in Gaza and also Lebanon because their economies are in the toilet. But it's also true of Egypt, which is having a lot of economic problems as well. Plus, these gas fields would attract huge international investment, but, of course, only if the area is stable. So the last thing Israel really needed right now was a war. All that investment's going to evaporate along with all their attempts to offer gas-powered sweeteners. So the last week has just blown all this right out of the water. I don't know why did this happen now? A lot of people are asking that. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why this. A lot of reasons have been put forward. This normalization I was talking about. Palestinians were being left out of the picture. The great powers, the monarchies, were all lining up with the US and Israel. Where did the Palestinians fit in? They didn't. Then, of course, there's divisions within Gaza between Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which Islamic Jihad are possibly trying to take control. So Hamas felt like it had to do something. Then there's conflicts with the West Bank under Fatah, which runs the Palestinian Authority there and is seen as collaborationist, incompetent and corrupt. So perhaps Hamas thinks it can take control of the West Bank. Then, of course, you've got the internal constitutional crisis in Israel itself caused by Netanyahu, who's trying to cut the judiciary off at the knees because they're trying to investigate him for corruption. So he's just pulled a Trump. He's decided to neuter his own judiciary to prevent them investigating him. And this, of course, as you probably know, has caused the biggest protests in Israel in its history, as well as elements of the IDF threatening to go on strike. Other reasons why it could have been now and not a month ago or next year. The timing seems pretty unlikely to be a coincidence that it was 50 years ago from the surprise attack of the Yom Kippur War. Then there's opportunism. The things have been kicking off for the last 18 months in the West Bank. There was 11 Palestinians just shot there just today. The IDF sent over 25 battalions and took a lot of them away from Gaza. A former IDF intelligence chief told the Washington Post that there was a need for more soldiers. So where did they take them from? From the Gaza border, where they thought it was calm. Then I don't know if you've heard anything about the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is a big sort of powder keg as well. But I'm not going to go into all of this because it'll get to be too much. One thing, a spokesman for Hamas said a couple of days ago that they didn't expect, well, they expected a lot more resistance than they actually got. He said, "We were surprised by this great collapse. We were planning to make some gains and take prisoners to exchange them. This army, the IDF, was a paper tiger." So a bit like it calls to mind the 9/11 thing again. They've succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. They've struck a blow that was much worse than they had any right to expect it would be. But at all events, Hamas must know what's going to happen now. They've committed suicide on behalf of the whole of Gaza. Now the IDF has told Gazan city residents to evacuate, and Hamas is telling them to stay put. I mean, Hamas clearly wants Palestinians to die in their thousands just to make Israel look bad. I just think the cynicism of these people, you know, it goes beyond words, really. So, brief thoughts about what's going to happen. Well, there's Lebanon and Hezbollah. Hezbollah's lost a lot of popularity in Lebanon recently. It lost its parliamentary majority in 2022. So there's not likely to be much Lebanese support for a war. Plus, Lebanon is in really bad straits economically. They couldn't afford a war. So, unless Iran gives Hezbollah direct orders to invade, it doesn't really look like anything's going to happen on that front. And Iran itself has got fairly good reasons not to get involved in this. It's been going through some rapprochement with Saudi Arabia via China and also with America via Oman. And there are $6 billion worth of Iranian assets which were due to be unfrozen by the US in exchange for some US hostage releases. So Iran's got some skin in the game, but not in the way that is being reported by most of the media. And if Iran isn't keen to get involved in this, it would also explain why Hezbollah hasn't done very much, apart from a few desultory rocket attacks. Syria's also been very silent. Syria's got, Syrian government would probably quite like to get back the Golan Heights, but there's been no murmur from that direction. The only thing that seems really obvious is that this ground invasion is going to go ahead, and Netanyahu has really got no option at this point. He's allowed this situation to blow up on his watch. He's already got a very fragile grip on power because he tried to neuter the judiciary, as I mentioned before. He's got to throw everything at this, otherwise he's going to be out of office in a week's time and then facing those corruption charges that he's been trying to prevent. The prospects for people in Gaza, well, I mean, you know, it doesn't bear thinking about. It's an open prison. It's a tiny space, 25 miles by 6 miles, with the highest density of population of people practically on Earth. But a ground invasion is probably playing right into the hands of Hamas. It's probably the worst thing that the Israelis can do. They abandoned Gaza in 2005 because it was too expensive to occupy then. Urban warfare actually negates the huge military advantage that Israel has got in terms of hardware, tech, jets, drones and all the rest of it. A report from The Economist yesterday pointed out that Hamas has always been very good at urban warfare. It's quite ruthless. They wear captured IDF uniforms and all sorts of things. And let's not forget that they say they've got 300 miles worth of tunnels under Gaza. So fighting would be house to house, room to room, t- tunnel to tunnel. The casualties on both sides, you know, are likely to be stupendous. And on what would be the result at the end of it? Quite probably that Israel will finally abandon Gaza as a sort of shell. And then if there's anyone there at all, Hamas or something like it will come back, because, you know, these issues are never going to go away. This argument is never going to be resolved, not inside capitalism anyway. This is going to be, or it could be, Israel's sort of mini Vietnam. And, you know, as things stand, as the atrocities pile up, what will the Palestinians on the West Bank do? Are they going to stand by and allow it? And if the West Bank goes up, one wonders what Jordan will do. Jordan's got a peace deal treaty with Israel, but recent polls show that 84% of Jordanians are deeply hostile to Israel, probably because most of them are Palestinian, in fact. Okay, well, I think I've talked for quite a long time. I was going to talk a bit about what other groups have said, what governments are saying, what other political parties have said, but I think that's probably enough. I think it's probably time to turn this over to what you've got to say.